From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the program, we meet a teacher in Detroit who is looking for a way to connect with her students after the crush and confusion of the pandemic.
And we just had no idea what was going on. I really feel like if we had known a little early, we could have sent our children home with some kind of preparation packages or whatever, but it was an abrasive cutoff. Just like, wow, I was shocked. I'm still shocked.
So teacher Von Seal Campbell decided she would read online to her students every night. She'll tell us how it's going. Then we check in with writer and funeral director Thomas Lynch about this unique period of mourning.
I've always thought of funerals as essentially a collaboration between the living and the dead. Humans are distinguished by the fact that they do these things. They pause when one of their own kind dies.
Those stories and more coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later this hour, one funeral director will sit down to tell us what's changed and what hasn't about the work of helping with life's final transition.
Humans are distinguished by the fact that they do these things. They pause when one of their own kind dies.
But first, so many Michigan kids are cut adrift from their school communities, their days upside down, their academic path suddenly dependent on their family's ability to pay for devices and internet service. But teachers and parents are already working on ways to keep kids connected. We found one Detroit school teacher who's been getting online every evening for story time.
Welcome, one and all. Let's meet our new friend. Her name is Mia, and she'll be with us till the end. She smiles, she grins, and like you, she is kind. She thinks about things with a positive mind.
Von Seal Campbell is a master math teacher for elementary grades K through 5 in Detroit Public Schools Community District. She's been teaching in Detroit for 9 years. I asked her about her first thoughts when she realized what's happening with the school year and the coronavirus.
I was absolutely afraid because when they ended the school year, it was so abrupt. It was a very abrasive cutoff. We had not really heard anything really too serious. You know, we heard of a couple of coronavirus cases, but at the end of the school day, we dismissed our students. And then all of a sudden, like 10 minutes after dismissal, we received an email saying that students would not be returning the next day and that they were, you know, possibly going into quarantine. At that point, they told us it would be 2 weeks. And we just had no idea what was going on. I really feel like if we had known a little early, we could have sent our children home with some kind of preparation packages or whatever, but it was an abrasive cutoff. Just like, wow, I was shocked. I'm still shocked.
Were you able to track them down at home?
Very few. I use the system, the app called Class Dojo, where I'm able to communicate with my parents via text message, pretty much. It's a telephone app where you can just send messages out about, you know, anything that's going on in school as far as field trips or parent notes or just direct communication based on a student's behavior or possibly illness or something like that. I have 32 students in my homeroom. And to date, after reaching out on a daily basis via text messages, Google Voice, as well as Class Dojo, I've only really been in communication with about 5 out of 32.
Wow. How did you hit on the idea of reading to kids online?
You know, I talked to a couple of students through Class Dojo. And again, like I said, you can use that app and you can text back and forth just as though you're, you know, just as if you're kind of just sending a text message. Mm-hmm. And our kids are like, you know, we really miss you. And, you know, we really wish we could see you. And this was just a couple of days after school let out. And I was like, wow, you know, what can I do to just kind of just, I was missing the kids and I wanted to do something that the kids could really relate to and connect to. So I decided I would read a bedtime story and post it on Facebook. And I had no idea that it would just be like, it would blow up that way. I had no idea whatsoever. I was thinking I would just reach a few people, my friends who have children who I reach out to sometimes just checking on them because they're pretty much mostly Detroit Public School students. I had no idea, but they really enjoyed it. And all the feedback I received back on day one made me do day two. Did I know I would reach day 30? No, but here we are.
Was there somebody who read to you when you were a kid?
Oh, absolutely. My mother read to me every day until, and then it, I guess when I reached about fifth grade, I started reading to her, but she still read to me. That was something that was just a ritual in our house every single night. 7 days a week, right after dinner, we would get, my mother would read to us.
That's lovely. What kind of books are you choosing for kids to listen to for your evening readings now?
Well, right now, I look for books based on their topics. So right now, you know, I try to work with like growth mindset books and reassurance books and, you know, books about just changes and how you feel emotionally. I've read books about, you know, being angry and how do you deal with that. I've read books on how not to give up when you try to do something that doesn't work out the first time. So I work on books that I think will be, you know, beneficial emotionally and psychologically going through this time, as well as entertaining at the same time. So, you know, it's really amazing. One author reached out to me today before yesterday, Jessica Colaco, who wrote Forense's Big Light, which is a story about self-acceptance. And I was so happy to hear from her. And I told her, you know, I really appreciate authors that write children's books that deal with real life issues, but also involve those fictional characters, but where the kid can actually connect to it. You know, that's so I really enjoyed that. So it was really nice to hear from her.
Is it difficult to get the books that you need right now?
Yes, it's quite a challenge. I use Amazon Kindle. Now, I have a book collection at school, but we have no access to the school, so I cannot get a hold of any books to read. So I've been using the free Kindle downloads using Kindle Unlimited. And, you know, those vary from here and there. So I have had to pay for some books. So I've been looking out to try to get a hold of some resources. I tried to use checking out from the library, but with the Detroit Public Library, you have to have a PIN number to get those. And I have not been able to access that because there's nobody available in customer service. Mm. So I do struggle a bit to get a hold of titles. So I do a lot of, some big amounts of time of my day is looking for books to read and, you know, to access some. Because one thing I really enjoy doing and the reason why I like to use electronic books is because I like to insert pictures and create iMovies so that the pictures will pop up after each page, because that too makes a great connection with children when they can actually look at that picture. Because one of the first ways that children read is through looking at pictures.
Right. And connecting the pictures with the stories.
Exactly.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Vonsiel Campbell. She's a math teacher who's been reading to her students every night online. You've taught a lot of different grades and kids and subjects. Is there an age group, age-wise, that you're concerned about the most right now?
I'll say yes. You know, I teach third grade this semester. Third graders have, you know, they're pretty good at being able to understand and follow, you know, basic life instruction and information because they've unfortunately been exposed to a little bit too much. So they have a little bit easier way of understanding some things. So I think about the grade like K through two, they really don't understand and process exactly what's going on around them. And school becomes a safe haven for these children. It becomes something that's routine that they have adjusted to being a part of their life, period. They know that Monday through Friday from 8 o'clock to 3:30 or so, I'm going to be in school with this teacher who cares about me, who is always telling me that I'm great, you know, who's very encouraging, and I'm going to be with my classmates. And I'm making these friends. And all of a sudden for that to just stop, you know, it concerns me that they just don't understand. I have a first grader who's a relative of mine, and she really struggles, you know, so every night she's tuned in to my stories at 8 o'clock because she just so happens to go to the school that I teach at. And she's like, you know, why can't we come back to school? When am I going to see you again? And I'm answering these questions. And I literally have to say, in all honesty, my eyes get misty and I have shed a tear talking to students through the Zoom with the camera right in my face. And I'm like, oh my goodness, because they cry. They're like, we missed you, Miss Campbell, you know, and I'm just like, oh my God, it's just so hard. So they are struggling. They are struggling. So the K through two is my biggest concern.
It's easy to imagine parents themselves just being overwhelmed right now.
Yes, I am an overwhelmed parent myself. So I understand.
What's getting you through the days right now?
You know, planning, you know, thinking about the future. I spend, like I said, a lot of time doing research on books and trying to communicate with a few kids that I communicate with. And I look forward to recording a story every day because it's become just, you know, a connection for me, myself, starting with the fact that I can just replace my everyday self with this fictional character and live through the story. If it's just 4 minutes to 7 minutes, I think my longest story so far has been about 9 minutes long. I look forward to that because it provides and brings about just as much comfort to me as it does those that are listening. So, I mean, honestly, reading a story every night has become my daily goal, you know, because we have not started our implementation of online instruction yet. It will be starting at the beginning of the week coming up. So reading the stories helps. It fills in that gap for me.
It would certainly be understandable if you were just getting through your time minute by minute or hour by hour. But I wonder, have you been talking at all with some of your coworkers in the school or maybe friends about what teaching might look like over the next year before a vaccine is developed?
Yes, absolutely. I've of course taken some classes online before myself, but we do talk about that. We talk about the amount of time that, you know, we kind of feel sorry because a lot of kids do not have access to technology in their homes, and that's going to be a really huge issue. And so the district talked about giving the kids a laptop or a tablet, but once the kids have that, they don't have online, they don't have internet access in their homes. You know, how can we make sure that the children will have parents at home that will wake them up on time and get them online on time and really make sure that they're doing their studies? Because I've seen a little bit of what the struggle is going to be like already with the Zoom meetings that we've been holding with these 3 and 4 students at a time. You have a lot of background noise. You have siblings in the background. It's just so much stuff going on. It's unfortunate. Yes, I do teach right in the city of Detroit, where, you know, unfortunately, the home life for some of these students is just unfortunate, and they don't have the support and the things that they need to really get them, you know, through, you know. So teachers are their biggest support system. So they're not, you know, they don't get a lot of extrinsic motivation at home when it comes to their education. And it really worries me, because if we go on to strictly online instruction, I feel like more kids are going to fall behind. I don't even know what we're going to do about standardized testing, but I just feel like more students are going to be behind, and Detroit is already really known for their low, low test scores. And I just am really worried about that. I have no idea what this is going to look like. All I can do is do my best to reach as many students as I can and support them the best way I can, and just try to stay in touch with parents and make sure that they understand, you know, what the teacher's goal is, and that we need their support, because it takes a team. The parents and teachers have to work together, because we are all a part of the village, and it takes a village to raise and educate a child. So
if anybody out there from DPL or other library systems are listening, might be able to help. Is there anything you'd like them to know right now?
So I would love to get information on some online books that I can check out and read and just, you know, electronically check out and return. That would be great. I'd appreciate that.
Von Seal Campbell is an elementary grade master math teacher for Detroit Public Schools Community District. Von Seal, thank you so much for everything you're doing right now.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
When we come back, one writer thinks about the words that will heal.
Whenever you write, it's the now that I think we have to pay attention to.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Words fail us in moments like the one we're experiencing right now. Hospitals at capacity, the eerie quiet of most streets and public spaces, and wave upon wave of grief experienced in solitude. We turn to the written word to get us through. With us now is poet Anne-Marie Ullman. She's the author of several collections of poetry, including Lake Michigan Mermaid, A Tale in Poems. She teaches creative writing at Interlochen College of Creative Arts. We spoke with her from her home near Empire. Anne-Marie, welcome.
Thank you. I'm enjoying hearing your voice. Appreciate it.
How are you doing?
We're doing well. We're surviving, and I think in probably the best way possible. We're fortunate to live in a more rural area, so we have a lot of the natural world around us, and that's a comfort. And I realize that's also a privilege. I'm grateful for that.
I've heard so many writers in so many different parts of America joking in the past few days about the fact that the world is finally catching up with them. They've been practicing physical distancing for years because of how they work. Does this feel different for you?
Oh, sure. Because even though I agree that introversion is really part of what we practice, because we have to have that alone time, we don't ever write outside of community. Everything in the world is touching us in some way, I think. We are all part of various symbiotic communities, even though the work that we do alone is in isolation. So that part is different. I'm cut off from a number of literary communities, at least physically. So there's an entirely different attention and awareness that I'm experiencing right now.
You've been writing some poems that are specific to this moment and posting them on your blog, which is kind of the way everyone's publishing at the moment. Would you read one for us?
Oh, sure. I'll read one of the very earliest ones that I wrote. And it's called Quarantine's Touch. It's about that experience of realizing that we can't be in close proximity anymore and just what that feels like. There's a reference here also to Interlaken in this. I think you'll see it. Quarantine's Touch. I walked the empty road to a neighbor's house. I hesitated to knock. I'd have to touch the door. But then I did. She came. Her hair mussed, smiled, and put her palm against the glass, and I put mine against the cool on my side. Did it warm? I'm not sure. And I asked what she needed, and she said she was good, doing fine, though her eyes were red. And like I said, her hair was not combed, nor was mine, so what's the deal? Then she said she was isolating herself because she'd taught straight to the end, had been in their presence all the way until they had left her room to board their planes, and I nodded. Asked if I could bring her wood for the stove. She smiled. Yes, that would be good. And kindling if I had extra, I did. And as I turned away, I saw our warming print, the glass impressed with mist condensed, the wrinkled ring where calluses had rested, and two, the sea through hollow at the center, where our palms had faced each other's, but had not flattened against that border. There, no smudge of touch, and I could see where our first language should have been.
That's Quarantine's Touch, read by the poet who wrote it, Anne-Marie Oman. Anne-Marie, small physical details are as natural to poets as a chef's knife is to a home cook.
Yes.
All the details of the handprints on the glass of the door, do those details take on different qualities now as the details that we have in every day are down to a smaller number of interactions?
Oh, I think so. It feels like everything is a little elevated now, like there's a super light on it. I find myself feeling and experiencing things almost metaphorically immediately. There's more to everything that we're doing than just the simplicity or the ordinariness that we forget most of the time. There's that heightened, highlighted feeling, elevated in a way, even in ordinary language.
I gathered from reading this poem that this is someone else who teaches at Interlaken,
yes,
who's keeping isolated because she was with her students up until the time when they left.
And it's an international school, so, you know, there was that. They're all home now.
You sometimes travel for work. Do you find yourself missing that right now?
Oh, yes. I find a longing for proximity that we can't suffice with Zoom or Skype or any of those, FaceTime. It is not the same as being in the presence of somebody where you can actually touch and feel what they're experiencing and what you're experiencing with them.
Do you find that you're inhabiting your home in a different way?
Well, the quiet is something I think that we hadn't realized we would enjoy. It was a surprise in a certain way because we're social people, as many of us are, and we like being out and about. And the quiet has an enrichment that's happening that I think we're sensitizing to and hearing more into it than we thought we would. It's a deeper sort of experience than I expected, and I hate to say this because I know so many people are not in this situation and they're suffering, but it's something I'm embracing right now. I'm trying to get inside of it.
You wrote another poem that was about a very specific part of your home that you've been spending time with. Will you read it for us?
Oh, you mean the garden?
Yes.
Oh, sure. And that is new, and we call it the novel. So hang on just a second here.
Sure.
This one is called Vaccine. Once decided, and without any idea of cost, we figured out first how we'd break the sod. to dig that dead orchard's turf. We figured it would take some work and we'd have no help. We figured out an old-school strategy planned first for deer. The fence had foiled us last time we tried. Now a protective picket pocked with posts every 8 feet, heavy mesh of wire, a gate, and buried trickle hose with bucket standing at attention on the north. Then troweling the roots and building beds, we could even add compost left from years' abandonment, a rotted pile never used, manure, some organic dirt, topsoil from our woods. Is it this that led us out of viral funk? Just the idea of an attempt has, for 3 days, kept at bay the mind's disease, that noise. A garden is not much, but it changes the way the light comes on. Or maybe it's the spring. There is that. But in the end, just today, we walk the field, rake the weeds away, set the stakes, tape a reckless boundary, get our hands so dirty we have to scrub even harder than we did before. And perhaps that, too, is protecting us.
That's Vaccine.
Yes.
As read by Anne-Marie Oman, poet who lives near Empire, if you're just joining us. You know, so often, Anne-Marie, we look to yards and gardens to remind us of change and the turning of the seasons. But listening to that, it feels like they can also mark for us some of the things that endure.
That endure, indeed. And I think that's part of why so many of us are turning to gardens right now, is it's a way to look in a positive way, to look at a future. And I know the simple thing is, well, we're growing food, but it's also an investment in a whole process of vitality and life and trying to find ways to keep that kindled in all of us.
Yeah. Do you find yourself much reflecting lately on how fast life has changed?
Oh, deeply. Deeply. That's so much of why I had to write these, is I wanted to, in some way, capture the moment, to be in the presence of this moment as much as I could. Some writers don't find it easy to write at times like this. And if you can manage to be just present to it and hold it so that the memories sear in a little bit, then it becomes fodder for later. But whenever you write, it's the now that I think we have to pay attention to. And that's been part of my reflection. I've been doing a lot more of that even as I continue my work.
How are you coping with how fast things have changed?
Well, the garden was one thing. I have, fortunately, again, the time right now to take walks, to be outside a little bit more, to listen deeply to what's happening in the air. The birds are returning. They don't know we're having a pandemic. The warblers are coming back through here, and there's an awful lot of vitality happening in our wetlands. The peepers are coming back. And so those are small things that I think not everybody has a kinship to, or maybe they just don't have that available. But that is all bringing home the necessity we have to pay attention to Earth, I think, and what's being said in this time.
Speaking of which, I think you have one more poem for us. Do you want to set this up before we hear it?
Yes, this is about one of those walks, and it's me being present to, or trying to be present to, something that I saw that I don't know that I normally would have seen if I weren't trying to be in this moment a little bit more. And this is called Something Rising, and I also hope it's a lesson for all of us about what the world is doing. Something Rising. Walking the old road again, I heard them, chortling high as they flew, that chuckle that sounds like family gossip, though of course it's not. They appeared below rain-stained clouds, a dozen sandhill cranes against the sky, together in a flock. Then to the north, another sound, like theirs, but off, higher, both in sky and pitch, and if I were to assign it tone, frantic would be it. Scanning skies behind the flock, there, too high, a crane, almost lost in cloud, alone, struggling to keep up, but falling behind. And from it came that call. Here we are, I thought, nature's cruelty, survival of the fittest, social Darwinism, etc., we know the drill. Then the pull of sadness, companion of my day. And so I was about to turn away when a third cry sounded through the mist, a lower honk, insistent and short, and there I saw one from the many break, leave the now distant gang, arc back toward that meandering one, calling in return, galumph, galumph, as in, come on, come on, and with a final cry, short, desperate, and high, the lost one found its guide. I stood in the empty road, brain stunned by what I'd seen, some animal instinct rising to save, after all, the least of us.
I think anyone who's spending time with dogs and cats can testify how much animals can be a lens on this moment, but I confess I hadn't thought about birds.
Well, it was remarkable. They are taking care of each other in their own way, too. And yes, I think our animal companions are a huge part of the comfort we can keep right now. It's amazing how we make connection, you know, even if we can't see each other, we can hold close our animal friends and books and letters and all of those things that serve as proxy.
Well, if that's not a sign of hope, I think it'll do till one gets here.
I agree. I hope that's true.
Anne-Marie Oman, thank you so much.
Thank you, April, for having me.
Anne-Marie Oman coming to us from her home in Leelanau County. She teaches creative writing at Interlochen, and you can read these and other poems on her personal website. New titles are publishing every day, even as most of us stay in stasis. Stateside's book critic Keith Taylor has this review of a new book from Michigan author Kelly Forden.
Several Michigan authors had the bad luck of publishing new books in the days or weeks just before the lockdown we find ourselves in right now. Bookstores are closed, libraries are closed, all public events have been canceled. The media is understandably preoccupied with events that might change history. New books have been forgotten for a while, which is a loss for their authors, of course, and for their readers, too. Some of those books might be among the most enjoyable published this year. For instance, take Kelly Forden's new collection of short stories called I Have the Answer. Most of us, particularly at this moment in time, are going to look at that title and smile at the irony of it. Yeah, sure, who has the answers for anything right now? Forden takes it that way, too. Most of the protagonists in these stories are women, and women of a certain class, those college-educated suburban women we hear so much about these days, the people who have come to decide our elections. For the most part, the women in these stories, which usually take place in southeastern Michigan, are struggling with careers or have given them up because of the grueling demands of wifing and mothering. It isn't easy, and it isn't rewarding. Their husbands play golf and ignore their responsibilities. The women don't have time to make the friends they would like to make. They see the women around them struggle with illness, depression, and abandonment. Their children either ignore them or despise them. Life is not the easy suburban bliss they are too smart to expect, but still secretly hoped for. And what's most amazing about Forden's accomplishment is that she reinvigorates this story. On the edges of despair, they are even sometimes funny. For instance, the last story in I Have the Answer, wonderfully entitled, Why Did I Ever Think This Was a Good Idea?, begins like this. Bridget Flanagan stood in the middle of what used to be her studio, a discordant sound, could it really be called music, was coming from her son William's room directly above her head. She could ask him to turn it down, but that would require interacting with him, possibly screaming at the top of her lungs. She couldn't bear the thought, so she remained amid the thumping and screaming, surrounded by shopping bags. That choice is kind of sad, of course, but most of us who have had children can understand it. And I don't think I'm perverse in seeing just a little bit of humor in the knowledge that the parent is almost helpless. Don't get me wrong. There's more to these sharply observed stories that are told in Fordham's crystal-clear prose. Amid all their struggles, these very real characters find their moments of love and the possibilities of their hopes fulfilled, even if that dream is very faint, off on a distant horizon. These are stories of our time, or what was our time before the pandemic, and what we hope might be our time again, and of our place, and of the people we recognize living here.
In a moment, funeral director Thomas Lynch talks to us about what grieving means when the bereaved can't come together. That's after a short break. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Physical distancing rules that we're all living with right now also apply to funerals. Even as many families have people to mourn, beloved people who lived long lives full of folks who are missing them, we're not really in a position to gather for long remembrances full of stories and tears and laughs, with plates of food to pass around and glasses to raise. So how do we grieve and honor the dead right now? Thomas Lynch is funeral director and president at Lynch & Sons Funeral Home. It serves several communities in Michigan, including Brighton, Lapeer, and Walled Lake. He's also a poet and essayist. Thomas Lynch, welcome.
Thanks, April. I'm glad to be here.
Will you tell us where you are right now?
I'm at the south end of Mullet Lake in northern Michigan, about a half hour south of the bridge. And my son, Michael, embargoed my being in the office because I have all of the preconditions that would make me high risk. So he sent me up here to live alone with a dog. And the dog's getting tired of it. But we're doing okay.
Yeah, I wonder if it's difficult to be away from work right now.
It is, and particularly because I know the pressure they're under in a lot of ways, not only the, you know, the actual work that must be done, but I think for everybody involved in last things, the families that, you know, we're serving and the dead that we're trying to get to their proper dispositions. I think this physical distancing and the contagion both informs and bewilders us. So I spend the day on the phone and on virtual meetings and trying to, you know, assist them in ways that I can. But the real work is the heavy lifting and the large muscles, the heart and the shoulders and the rest of it.
You've been at this for many years now. What do you see funerals doing for us at a time when we've lost someone?
I've always thought of funerals as essentially a collaboration between the living and the dead. And so I see the essential elements of a funeral. You know, we tend to concentrate on all the accessories, the boxes, the bagpipers, the mum plants and hoopla. But the real essentials of a funeral are four. You need a corpse, someone who agrees to quit breathing forever. And sadly, we're inundated with those from strange sources that we never have had before. You need mourners, someone to whom it matters. You need a story, and the story is about the one who has died, and it's not only their biography, but it's also what they believed in, what they hoped for, what they held close to their heart, their spiritual and religious impulses, the things that informed their values. And finally, and very importantly, we need the transport. We need to get the dead where they need to go, because by doing so, the living get where they need to be. So it is this collaborative conduct that every culture, you know, as long as, you know, for 50,000 years, if you watch a certain channel, will tell you that humans are distinguished by the fact that they do these things. They pause when one of their own kind dies. So those four things, April: corpse, mourners, story, and transport. And the trouble with the current pestilence is that it separates those things physically, and they are basically physical enactments. A corpse is not the idea of the thing. The body is the thing itself, and it is by getting the body where it needs to go. In the case of our dead, they need to get burned or buried or entombed or into some abyss that we choose for them, whether it's the sea or the grave or the fire or the tomb. By getting them there, we get to do that. And by showing up to assist the family with that, we're saying, we'll take our part of that burden, that heavy lift. Mm. We'll help you carry that. And that's not happening now because we fear contact with one another, and properly so.
Well, what are the restrictions on the funeral services that Lynch and Sons can offer right now? Are there certain practices that you've had to put in place?
We've had to, of course, limit the number of people who can participate to 10. That's by, you know, the directive of our governor, and by the good orderly direction of the CDC and common sense dealing with the coronavirus. So that only takes the immediate family to where, you know, they can basically see and say goodbye briefly to their dead, and then they can carry them to their final disposition, whether it's the open grave or the open fire or whatever it happens to be. And that's hard duty to be done alone. But by the time you have pallbearers and, an immediate family, my mother's sister, our Aunt Sally, died yesterday, the bed of heaven to her.
I'm so sorry.
And she was 92. And I know someplace in the sparkling future there will be a religious ceremony to mark her long faith life and the hope that she had of heaven. And but right now, I think she's probably being buried, and the people who bury her, like the people who probably consoled her in the, you know, the care facility that she was in these last months, they're doing the best they can to bring humanity to bear on that circumstance, but they are not the people that she would want or would want to be with her. So it's, these are difficult times, and we hope to make up the difference in future, but we have to wait and see and take a day at a time and keep the grieving and the mourners in our prayers, because in a sense they're trying to do a virtual lift and a virtual transport.
Right.
And they don't have anyone to tell the story to.
Well, part of what you do is to provide that emotional support as people go through the rituals of their grief. Are there ways that you can help at a distance?
Every time we give, you know, every time a family seizes on the sort of deeply human duty of taking care of their dead, they are moving in the right direction when it comes to dealing with their grief. We deal with death, April, by dealing with our dead. We sometimes think that, you know, a memorial service or a celebration of life will do the job, and it may well do, but the essentials have to be there. And among the essentials is the dealing with our dead, and not the idea of them, not a photograph, not a recording. Those things will stand in when they have to, but in the best case scenario, the ways that we conjure our dead usually happen in community, in cahoots with the people we love the most and who loved our dead the most with us. So that communion is very important. And to the extent that the current plague disallows that, we are hurt by it.
You know, because our society tends to be averse to talking about these things, many of us don't have the language to talk about death and grief on a daily basis, but funeral directors certainly have those skills. Do you have any thoughts on how to cope with seeing so much grief all around us right now?
I don't know that funeral directors are any more expert than other humans. And I think that if we love, we grieve. And to the extent that we do love, we, you know, grief will have its way with us. So the things that help us most in grief are the companionship of others who are willing to share our grief. The rule of thumb, Edgar Jackson, an old Methodist minister, may his memory be eternal, used to say that grief shared is grief diminished. It's as if you have this stone you have to push uphill. I think there was a myth by that name. But the more the merrier, April. The more people who get under the box that has to be lifted from this place to the next, the lighter the load is for everyone. So to the extent that FaceTime and all the social medias put us in closer contact, even though we're only getting glimpses and virtual glimpses of one another, those things all help. This morning I watched the funeral mass of a funeral director friend of mine who died last week, and the mass was in Gaylord. His name was Chuck Nelson. Since I was a boy, painting parking blocks for my father's funeral home, I remember Chuck Nelson because he served his apprenticeship with us. And here he is at the end of his life, his darling Patricia, I think they were married for ever and a day. She's there with her children, but they had 10 people at a mass that would have had thousands, because Chuck had been the funeral director in Gaylord for well over half a century. But we must take care of one another the best way we can. So, you know, I've attended virtual 12-step meetings, virtual poetry readings, virtual book club meetings. If you ring me, I'll be in any meeting, because otherwise I'm talking to Carl the dog, and he doesn't know the pandemic's on, so he just thinks this is normal. And it's not. We need one another. And if there is a silver lining, as they say, possibly we'll know that need more keenly when this is over.
Do you worry about people becoming numb to death and to grief in this moment when so many people all around the world are just wrapped in it?
What I worry about is the disconnect, April. I mean, grief is going to have its way with us. My father, may he rest in peace, used to say, you can pay the undertaker, pay the bartender, pay the shrink, but you're going to pay the price. Grief will have its way with us. If you love, you grieve. It's almost like the tax that we pay on love. And we can delay our taxes by a couple months, as we've done. But they are still certain as our mortality. The numbers are really convincing on this. 100% of us who are born die. And grief, which is the other side of that coin of love, will come calling for its pittance, whatever it might be.
You know, no one goes into your line of work, I think, unless they're prepared to meet people on their lowest days. do you find in talking to the folks who are on site at the business right now that this work has changed for them in the past couple of weeks?
They are remarkable. I think the men and women in funeral service across the nation and around the world are, you know, we call them the last responders, but they are every bit as exposed to the real costs of this contagion as anyone else is. But they go about their work because that's what they were called to do, and they see it, I am certain, not just as a living, but as a way of life, and not just as a job, but a calling, a true vocation. And those who do it well, not only do they see the dismal trade, the dark days, the hearts that are broken, but they also see the long history of love, the years of a long marriage, the way that she stubbed her toe and he said, ouch, and that they're going to have to learn another way to do it now. That's a spectacularly meaningful line of work to be in. I mean, I've always found it more meaningful than anything else. But, and I think my colleagues do as well, or they wouldn't do it.
Thomas Lynch is funeral director and president of Lynch and Sons Funeral Home. Mr. Lynch, thank you so much, both for your work and for your thoughts right now.
Thanks, April. God bless.
Monday on Michigan Radio's Morning Edition, you can hear more about the challenges that funeral homes and mortuaries are facing right now. We hope you'll be with us. A million and a half Michigan students have now been home for 5 weeks, sheltering in place. Everything they knew is different now. They can't hang out with their friends or go to school, not physically anyway, and most of them have no real schedule to speak of. Students from Community High in Ann Arbor called our hotline to talk about it and share how some of them are coping with it better than others.
It's 11:47 on Monday. Oh, God, I think it's the 13th. I don't even know anymore.
I can't remember what week it is. Honey, all the weeks are blending together.
I started really thinking this morning about how apocalyptic this all feels.
My brain can't comprehend the amount of trauma and chaos that is in the world right now.
I was kind of expecting things to die down a little bit, but I was wrong.
I feel like the past week or so, I've been super unmotivated. I'm used to always having things to do, and now that I don't, it's like the days go by super fast, and all I've done is, like, watch TV and maybe gone on a walk or, like, eaten a lot of toast or something.
My family, we all, most of us started showing, like, really mild symptoms.
My aunt has corona, which is scary. Not very bad, but still, that's the first person I've known to have it.
My dad went back to the hospital today. We know he's taking every precaution, but the thought of him being so exposed is terrifying.
I have definitely been struggling a little bit more with just kind of the feeling lonely and just missing my friends.
I haven't hugged another person who isn't my mom, dad, or brother in 3 weeks, and it's just, like, hard to wrap my mind around that.
This break is, like, mentally really, has been really good for me and refreshing, and I think it's just given me a lot of time to just think about the future.
Before all this, I was so busy, and it was really hard for me to have quality time with my parents, especially having divorced parents and going back and forth. It was like, my time is already so limited, and now I have more time. And I think that this has really just taught me to appreciate what I have and be grateful for what I can look forward to when this is done.
Everything is just different, and I hate that people keep calling this the new normal, because I don't want this to be the new normal. I want this to be a temporary normal. And I want things to just go back to the way they were when everything was okay. All right, bye-bye.
This piece was produced by Michigan Radio's Rachel Ishikawa. Support for Michigan Radio comes from the Michigan Health Endowment Fund and the Children's Foundation. That's our show for today. I'm April Baer. We'll catch up with you Monday. Stay safe and have a good weekend.